We're on a mission to help founders hit product market fit faster. We do this by interviewing founders that have been there. I'm your host, Adam O'Donnell. This podcast is put together by Zendesk for Startups. We offer 6 months free of Zendesk customer support suite for qualified product-oriented companies. Randy, welcome to Sit Down Startup Founder Podcast. I'm super excited to have you here. I know we've talked in the past and we just realized that small connection years ago, but tell me what Maxio does.
Well, Maxio is the mashup of two companies, SaaSops and Chargeify. They were brought together in 2021. What we offer is billing and rev rec and reporting. Why that's important to your audience is you got a bunch of founders who have a product, they want to get paid for it. And so they need to set up a system, payment usually, and then some sort of billing system with a billing portal. And we offer that, you know, like kind of like what Stripe does. The difference is we're focused on being with that founder through every stage of growth. So once you start to take private money, you move from cash accounting to accrual accounting. You have to think about things like rev rec and reporting. That's where the other side of the business really brings value. So we sit between your CRM, your general ledger. We help you get funded, stay funded, and grow.
And how would it compete with like a Chargebee or Recurly? I'm just trying to help further frame it for anyone who's listening.
So broadly, we would say, and this will go to our product market conversation in a bit, is our ICP is B2B software and services. Recurly is primarily B2C. So if you're a B2C guy, go to Recurly. Chargebee has B2C, B2B, and e-commerce. We only focus on B2B. And so we can get into some of the nuances of it, but you know, Chargebee is a viable competitor here. We have a very specific focus on what we can do term subscriptions, but usage-based pricing, usage-based billing. So a lot of the native AI companies are coming out and thinking about how to do pricing in terms of value-based pricing. We provide the billing, the reporting, the analysis for that billing model, which is a lot more complicated than just old selling seats on annual contracts. So we would say that we're in that future of where the market is going. I would love to talk to any of your listeners.
That's awesome. Well, I hope people check that out. I'm now curious to just kind of shift. Like, how did you even get planted in your head that you wanted to be a founder or CEO of a company? How old were you when you became like
this? Gosh, yeah. That's a great question, Adam. So if people look at my LinkedIn, I've been around for a while, three phases. First phase was in the military. I'd gone to the Naval Academy, went to the Naval Academy and thought I wanted to be an admiral. And that didn't work out. So I went to the corporate sector, went to business school, and at business school, you kind of get this concept of, you know, what does it mean to be a CEO? So it felt to me a natural extension of I wanted to be a leader. I've been practicing and failing at it for years. And in the corporate world, like if you get a chance to be CEO, it's a really wonderful one to be at the center of all information and to be engaging with each function. I talk about what's cool about the CEO roles, you get to fall in love with each function. So I'm working on finance problems one day, I'm working on engineering problems the next day, I'm working on sales problems. So I really like that general management opportunity. I didn't know if I'd be CEO. I feel very fortunate in terms of the people who invested in me. This is my third gig as CEO. I've been a public company CEO. I've been a private company CEO, Sequoia GGB, Lightspeed, First Round Capital backed. And now I'm at a PE-backed firm. And so again, for your listeners, if there's anyone who wants to chat about that, I'd be happy. They're very different contexts. I'm also writing about it, the 8 secrets of success for SaaS CEOs, and trying to take some of these hard-earned war wounds and help the next generation.
That is really cool. I'm just curious, like being real, what is it like being a public company CEO versus a private equity funded just with a lot of companies?
First, it was my first CEO. I was battlefield promoted to CEO. I was CRO at the time. And when they went through a big search, they couldn't find anybody to take the job and then say, what about you, Randy? And I said, no, not me. I don't want to do it. But my mentor at the time, who was the executive chairman, said, Randy, there are very few public company CEO gigs. If you want to do it, this is the time to do it. So I stepped into it. I would say that the thing that you find at a company that's big and public is first, your executive team is very experienced. So I felt like I was stepping into a role and I had these very seasoned executives that I was working with who's seen the movie a couple of times. And this is my first CEO gig. So total imposter syndrome. Number two, you're managing a board that's representing the public shareholders. It's just very different than when you're working with VC, who it's their money and they're controlling it. And they're making, you know, not making decisions, but have a very strong point of view. And then PE even more so. And then you just get into this rhythm in the public markets where you're really running a process around earnings. And so every quarter, you got to come out with how you're communicating and setting your targets. And you always got to beat and raise. And I think for tech companies, It's very hard. And that's why you're seeing a lot fewer going public, is they want to be sure they're at, like, now the threshold is like $500 million. And it's just very little volatility in the finance and business model. It's very hard to do a turnaround as a public company, because public company shareholders don't have an appetite for that. They're not paying attention. They just want to see the stock go up based on your earnings. And I think the other area, obviously, is you're now, rather than managing VCs, you're actually working with institutional investors and trying to get analysts to cover you. And so it is a very different type of management of stakeholders. And I think really kind of confining, because it's hard to engage in the type of hard work you need to do when you're public. And so I think we took Rocket Fuel private. I didn't move on with it, but a PE firm bought them. And they did a lot of the hard work we were trying to do, but it was very hard to do in the public markets.
Because the right things are not the cool things in the short term, and they're going to create a lot of issues.
Yeah. But so that's the point. If you're turning a business around, at Rocket Fuel, we were trying to move from a media arbitrage business to a platform business. So that meant the media arbitrage business was, you know, going down. We had this other, we grew a $100 million business in less than 2 years, a $100 million business, but it was a $500 million business with overall decrease. So they just, like, the public markets, again, just, it's very hard to understand what's happening. That's why you have the private markets. That's why you have the big PE firms. They can take something, shape it, add some stuff onto it, and, you know, relaunch it.
I love that. Well, I know this wasn't about that topic, but I wanted to hear it, and I appreciate the perspective. Let's talk about product market fit. And yeah, I know, because you have not been a just 0-to-1 founder, you have a unique perspective. And I think the very first thing you shared to me, I'll just, like, let you take it away, but tell me your perspective, product market fit.
You never finish product market fit. Product market fit is never done. And I think what happens is you have founders who have a real conviction around a specific problem. They build technology to solve that problem. They're out selling it, and they're getting validation from, you know, people other than their friends and family willing to buy it. And so I think a product market fit, the definition is, you got people who've bought it, but then have bought again, right? You've got people who've gone through a cycle on the renewals, and they're like, yeah, you've delivered the value you promised, and I'm willing to re-up. In fact, if you can show that, you know, with net retention, that you're actually driving upsells, that's incredible. The challenge is the market's going to move, the competitors are going to move. So even at Maxio, I mean, we're a large Series D company. One of the issues we're struggling with right now is the market has moved a little bit. And do we have the right capabilities? Are we selling the right product into the market to accelerate growth? And I would say, yeah, we're doing okay. We're not doing great. This whole new world of AI, you know, 2 years ago, people weren't talking about AI native, AI first companies in the same way they are now. And so all the investments going into those companies, we have an incredible solution for that. We have this thing called events-based billing. But guess what? In the market, that's called metering. We have usage-based pricing modules, reporting, and rev rec. Really hard to do, but we haven't packaged it in a way that's super compelling, that, you know, everyone who's doing AI first companies recognizes us as one of the leaders in the space. So that product market fit is anticipating where the market is moving, what customers need, and doing the hard product marketing work to translate your speeds and feeds into compelling value, get people to buy. So product market fit, working on product market fit, is never over.
Yeah, that is a great point. Help me with some of those research tactics that y'all are doing now, or have maybe done over the past year, to make sure that you're staying with where it is and who's leading that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's an interesting question. It depends on how big you are, right? Is the messaging resonating in the marketplace? And that's a core messaging positioning skill set that a CMO would have, or someone who does content thought leadership. There's a core product marketing skill set. And I think B2B, generally, when they're struggling, you're struggling because your product marketing isn't, you know, as robust as it could be. And so those folks they translate the features into value and sit between sales enablement and product. Wicked important. How do they keep up to speed? Well, you got to carve out time to meet with customers, do surveys. There's a great company out there called Winter. We do a lot of messaging and value testing with Winter. I'd recommend everybody look at them. They are an awesome company. Their CEO is great, and they can give you a lot of feedback. So think of it as, like, how are you getting listening posts? Other listening posts are the analysts. So if you're selling to enterprise and are in that world, you can, the Gartners, the Forresters, the IDCs. For us specifically, we're focused on the billing market. There's a great analyst firm out there called MGI. and they can help you. You know, they do the beauty contest, have you come in and demonstrate all that you got, and then they publish their report. And sometimes they tell you where you're not good, and you can take that as data and input. So as you're listening to your customers, you're listening to the analysts, I think investors could be really helpful in this case. So going back to early stage companies, when you take money, it's super important to understand who the partner is going to be on your board, not the person who sold the deal, who's going to be there every day with you and be helping you to provide insights. So do they have experience in your vertical? Can they point you to other people in that vertical to help you get up to speed? So when I joined Maxio, I didn't come from the office of the CFO. I spent 20 years in ad tech and martech. The general partner is a woman named Chelsea Stoner. I mean, she's probably forgotten more about the office of the CFO than I'll ever know. But she has her finger on the pulse, because guess what? Battery is seeing 7,000 deals a year through their corp dev motion, right? And there are basically our outside outsourced corp dev. They only do 15 or 20 deals, but they're pattern matching across the office of the CFO, and they have a thesis about it. So again, your investors could be an enormous help in terms of telling you why you're not as good as the other people that they're seeing and what you're missing. I mean, I think going on, like customer advisory boards, I think there's all sorts of things, getting to the appropriate events. Like for us, Saster, we want to sell to early stage founders. So getting in the mix at Saster with a booth and talking to people and finding out what they're doing and what they think about your capabilities and others. So it's market in versus product out. And I think sometimes technologists are, they're told no so much in terms of trying to build their product. They just, you know, and it's this, I don't know, the myth of Silicon Valley is they just gut it out and they just, they're going to change the world with their view of what the, you know, the Elon Musk thing. But I think, you know, 95% of successful companies are more able to, are successful for many reasons. But one is they're able to set up their listening posts and they're on top of the market.
Yeah, that's great. Help me with the metrics that you think best indicate sustained product market fit or durable product market fit?
Yeah, well, I think there's probably a couple. One is win rate against the competition. So you have win rate, and then you have specific, you're going head to head. Win rate, we were chatting a little bit earlier, like our billing capability, we're selling against Stripe. And Stripe is the behemoth, right? So we got to get super clear about our differentiation and how we help innovators unlock their next stage of growth. How much are we winning against Stripe in the deals that we want to be in? We're not doing the super early, but B2B software. Chargebee is another competitor. How are we competing against them? I'll just tell you that we're winning more. I'm not sure if we're in all the deals, but we're certainly the ones we're going at. And it's not just about giving away on price. It's because we've been super clear about what our capabilities are and how we're different. So that differentiation on the competitive win rates. Roll forward, once you get customers up and running, what we were talking about, the other metric is gross retention. So are they renewing? And in the B2B SaaS space, you got to be north of 90%. And I call that mid-market, SMB mid-market. If you're really just S, where there's a lot of churn, maybe it's 80-ish percent, 85%. And if you're enterprise, where you're doing multi-year deals, it might be 95%. But kind of the good threshold is 90% for mid-market companies, which is saying that customers are coming back and you've preserved that revenue. The third metric is, I think we were talking a little earlier, was the net retention. So the net retention, are people buying more from you, i.e., more seats, or you've gone across divisions, or you've added new modules. And so the classic land and expand, those three metrics, can you win more than your fair share? Are you growing faster than the market? So forth. Are you growing faster than the market? Are you have industry standard gross retention? And are you getting customers to buy more of what you got?
Yeah, that's so good. And with each of those, can you give me a little bit of a benchmark of ranges that you've seen that you would expect? Maybe even just starting with like the win rate and how you look at that, because I imagine every deal is a competitive deal. So is it like broken by the top five competitors?
You got it. So there's an overall win rate, and there's some great benchmarks out there. We don't track that one specifically, but Ray Reich from benchmarket.com, love his stuff. Kyle Porter, who used to work at OpenView and they used to produce a bunch of stuff there, has started a new VC. I forget what it's called. I'd go check out his stuff. His latest report, super interesting. I think the win rate, you got to get triangulated on your win rate for your size company, your size ACV, and your end market. So we're selling fintech in office of the CFO. We're going to have a different win rate than you would if enterprise selling ERP. You can use a historical trend to help you understand where you are. But if you're under 20%, something's wrong. I don't think there's many companies that in my space, which is, you know, mid-market, $30,000 average ASP, that's doing 50%. But so that's a range. On gross retention, as I mentioned, 90%, I think, is when investors look, when I'm looking at companies to buy, if they're below 90%, I scratch my head and say, okay, well, let's take a look and see what's happening. And then it's super important for the company to be able to break out the gross retention by segment, by region, by product. So where are they getting, where are they winning versus where they're losing? Because to our earlier point, they may have started in one market and moved to another one. So when I went to Percolate, for example, it was a social media platform focused on mid-market. We repositioned it to be effectively content marketing for the enterprise. And I broke the company's reporting into two segments. Here's the segment that we're moving out of. Here's the segment that we're moving into. If you had it at the aggregate level, the gross retention wasn't great. But, you know, it's okay, but it wasn't great because we were de-investing in the mid-market social media. So we moved into a new category, product market fit. Win rates were okay. Gross retention was okay. And then we sold the company to Seismic. So gross retention broke by segment, broken out by segment, region, product. Net retention, similarly, north of 100%. Based on your business model, which interestingly at Maxio, we sell based on your trailing 12 months of revenue. So we're not selling seat-based model. So if your revenue is going down, guess what? Our net retention goes down. And this is something that was new to me. I was like, oh my God, what, you know, how do we do this? How do you manage that? But in the closet or the hidden B2B tech recession that everyone's been experiencing over the last 2 years, we had a lot of customers that just weren't growing. They were still viable customers, but that reflected in our net retention number versus classically, like what I grew up in at Salesforce and other places was you sold seats, you sold modules, net retention was more of a transaction. You do an upsell, you know, 5% CPI or something like that. So net retention, business model dependent, but north of 100%.
Mm. And then the last one, are we going faster than the market?
Yeah, so that actually requires some work, right? And that's one of the TAM versus SAM, right? Your total addressable market. So we think, for example, we worked with MGI who helped us frame up the total addressable market for all billing, for all regions, for all segments is $16 billion by 2026. We only play in a little bit of that market. So when we think about our growth rates, how are we matching against that SAM? One of the things, Adam, and I'm happy to, you know, we should put it in the show notes, is we do have a what we call the Maxio Institute Growth Report. And that's the aggregation of the 2,000 plus customers that we have. We have the billing and invoicing data. So we're a system of record. So this isn't survey data. This is like no kidding system of truth. And what we've seen is that the growth rates across our customers who are all B2B SaaS is 17% in Q2. It's like 15% in Q1. We have another one, Q3, I think it was 17% as well. And so that's another benchmark people can use is when we split it by vertical and we split it by size. So if you say you're a $20 million company, you're in manufacturing tech and you use sales-led motion, here's the growth rate, here's the N. So you're looking always for those types of external benchmarks that then you set your growth target against. And if you're faster, you're taking share. If you're slower, you're losing share.
That's everything. Because I think it's easy to get excited about a growth rate at all, but you might actually be going slower than the market. And so it's actually really not much of a growth rate.
Yeah, I think to that point, you know, one of the things I tell everyone I ever work with is I'm a huge fan of like an ex-military, right? Like operational discipline. We're going to set plans. We're going to execute those plans. We're going to have a scorecard. We're going to have metrics and targets. And success is only relative to something else. It's not success in and of itself. So what is your metric? What's the target? The target has to be anchored in something. You could use historical trends. You could use market data like our survey or the benchmarking survey to help triangulate. If you're working with a VC or PE, they're going to have their benchmarks because they see all of these companies as well as their portfolio companies. And they're going to say, you know, for you in office of the CFO, your gross retention should be 85% or 94%. But you got to have that target. And then it becomes a conversation around, well, if we're not hitting that target, why not? What's not working? What could we be doing differently? And to your opening question around product market fit, is it a market issue, like the market is collapsing, or it's becoming super competitive? Like our cost per keyword has just gone crazy over the last 3 years. It's like 4x what it was when I started. That's mind-boggling that you're spending 4x on a keyword. And so our search spend, you know, hasn't grown that much, but we're not getting as many impressions and everyone's flipping out. So we're trying to figure out, you know, is it a market or is it an execution issue? And the execution issue is, do you understand your product market fit? Okay. Well, then it's execution on marketing and sales. And so then you got to work through all of those metrics to drive that going forward.
This is so good. I know this has been a little bit different for anyone who's listening around just a traditional product market fit, but I think that these have been really helpful to just, it's monitoring product market fit.
Yeah.
As you go.
What are the signals? What's the business radar that's helping you know whether you got product market fit or not? And the thing is, it's not just a lead. It's not just the CEO's responsibility. You got to get sales, marketing, customer success. And as you get bigger, you have those executives. You got to constantly be talking about, do we have product market fit? I'll just be perfectly frank. Some of our biggest customers leave because they've outgrown our functionality. You know, here's the people we have, and now they went to a different solution, an enterprise solution, because we're more mid-market. Then it's like, what do we got to do to sort that out? And is that worth the investment? So it really, thinking about product market fit is something we do every single month, every single quarter. It's part of the strategy conversation when I present to the board. At its core, what you're talking about is, do you have product market fit?
Do you have it? And do you still have it?
Like, and you still have it. How's it evolved? And you got to have those metrics to say, oh yeah, you know, we're doing well in this specific area, but we've let go of this other category. And you're being explicit about that, because then that informs overall, where are you making investments? How do you do dollars and people and relative priorities for roadmap? And you got a lot of people who will often be anchored to the old product. And it's hard for them to get into this new world reality, like the market's moved. Back then, Percolate, we were organic, so SEO, not SEM. And there were companies like Sprout, Spreadfast, and Sprinklr that were much bigger, and they had SEM integrated. We just couldn't compete there. And so you just got to be honest, like that's all sunk costs. That, mm-hmm. You know, we were great for a while, but the market has expanded and is different. So we don't have product market fit anymore. What do? You shut down the doors, or do you create a transition, not a turnaround, but an evolution into a new category, define your category, define the competitors, and can you compete in that category? That was at Rocket Fuel. We were moving out of media arbitrage and moving into platform and moving, which Trade Desk did super successfully. Now they're worth billions of dollars. We just, you know, we didn't do it in the same way. And so I think it's, again, this product marketing fit, listening posts, being super tuned to the market is wicked important.
Mm. Randy, thank you so much for your time. What's the best way to reach out to you if you had time? Which is it, X or LinkedIn?
I do LinkedIn, posts like crazy. Would love for people to follow. I'm putting out a lot of content. I do my own podcast on SaaS builders, which is targeted at early stage founders. I'm always happy to talk to folks. If you need 15, 20 minutes to talk about something, and they can reach me at randy.wotton@maxio.com.
Randy, thank you for your time. Thank you for listening. If you want to learn more about Zendesk for Startups, check out our website, zendesk.com/startups. Also, we're always looking to improve, so don't hesitate to email me with any feedback on how we can ask better questions, guests to target, or anything else that we can do to better help you as a founder. My email is adam.odonnell@zendesk.com.